This episode is brought to you by 10 East. Recent market cycles have highlighted the value of private market investing. And with access to these markets broadening, it can be hard to know where to find vetted, high-quality offerings. This is where 10 East comes in. 10 East is a platform where qualified investors can co-invest on a deal-by-deal basis across private equity, private credit, real estate, venture, and other one-off opportunities typically unavailable through traditional channels. The principals and partners of 10 East are investing in these offerings, and their level of sourcing and diligence is institutional grade. It's no surprise that founders, executives, and portfolio managers from leading investment firms are using 10 East to diversify their personal portfolios. Hello, everyone. I'm Eric Golden, and welcome to Making Markets. This show explores the psychology and structure that make up markets all over the world. Each week, we speak to experts about a different market so you can see what actually happens when money changes hands. From mainstream stock and bond markets to esoteric niches like vineyards, antique art, and crypto, we explain the transactions that underpin our economy. Making Markets is part of the Colossus family of podcasts, and you can find all our podcasts, including edited transcripts, show notes, and other resources at joincolossus.com.
Eric Golden is the CEO of Canopy Capital. All opinions expressed by Eric and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not necessarily reflect the views of Canopy Capital. This podcast is for informational purposes and should not be construed or relied on as investment, legal, or tax advice. Clients of Canopy Capital may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast, including positions that are contrary to the opinions offered.
My guest this week is Janik Mali. At 13, Janik was getting paid to make websites. 5 years later, he was an early employee at high-growth broker Saxo Bank. Today, he's a serial fintech entrepreneur, the co-founder and co-CEO of Public.com, an investing platform with a mission to make public markets work for all people. In this episode, we dive into the brokerage industry. We talk about how new age brokerage firms compete against giants like Fidelity and Schwab, the business model, including payment for order flow, and the impact of AI. Please enjoy this conversation with Janik Mali. So, Janik, the idea that brokerage companies could come out of nowhere for people who follow finance just 10 years ago was unheard of. There was Fidelity, Schwab, Interactive Brokers. That war had ended. So I thought a good place to start would be, how did we end up with new emergent disruptors in the brokerage business?
The peacetime didn't last for very long, did it? I think it's a function of technology, first and foremost. And with new technologies always come new opportunities. That sounds super cliche, but it just happens to be the truth. And you think you had a war called the discount brokerages. I would say those existed between you traded from the phone, you bought trading online, you go back and actually look at E-Trade's stock price when they were listed, and then you look at 2001 and how high that stock got before it essentially came back to normal levels. And you see some resemblance in some of that in and around what happened with COVID and GameStop and everything else, but it happened in a totally different platform for a different demographic. So our generation has been going to mobile, of course. And whenever there's a shift like that from the phone to web, from web to mobile, there's just also a new cohort of people, the next 80 to 100 million people that turn 18, can open a brokerage account and start to think, hey, I need to start investing myself and for my future. And that's what I feel is so wonderful about the space, because on the one hand, I have two things that are true simultaneously. You have these huge incumbent players with crazy amounts of assets. You look at the asset base of these companies, it's in a trillion sometimes, at least if you look at Fidelity and Vanguard. And at the same time, the reality just is that you have these and technology that brings new people in, and those new people prefer to do their business on more modern platforms with more modern solutions. And it's not just the product, it's how they learn about things. So the way that the boomer generation learned about investing is very different from the way that the millennial and even the Gen Z generations learn about investing, where it's much more YouTube, TikTok even, it's bite-sized, it's social, it's community-driven. So it just brings all these fundamental shifts, and that what I would say causes a full rewrite of what it means to be competitive in a space, especially if that generation, if you will. And I guess we'll get into it. But the question right now is that then what's happening from mobile to AI? Is that big enough of a technology shift that it can have as big as an impact as when you web from phone to web or web to mobile? And I think we're learning that in real time right now.
Before we get to AI, I want to just use a counterexample that didn't go this way that I think will have an interesting take on. When we went from the web to mobile, we saw the rise of robo-advisors. That fits the definition of new technology shows up for a new generation. And when that industry popped up, before the new form of brokerage has popped up, the major firms were essentially able to squash them very quickly. Just objectively watching this industry grow, I think the base assumption was with public.com and with Robinhood that would go the same way that robo-advisors, that the oligopoly, the large players could come in, but it didn't seem to have the same impact. So what did the robo-advisor industry get wrong that the self-directed brokerage industry is getting right?
I think there's mainly two things. I think the first thing is the type of engagement curve you see in these products are orders of magnitude different. So with a robo-advisor, you open that, call it a handful of times a year. So it's a very low engagement product. So therefore, the UX UI and how that's all done matters less than in a product you open 8 to 10 times a day, obviously. And I think that's one of the first differences is that self-directed brokerages, you have a totally different engagement curve. You have much more active use. So therefore, going mobile actually made sense. Going mobile on your robo-advisor, is that a 10x better experience than on the web? Probably not, because if you're only looking at it a handful of times a year, it doesn't really drive that much difference in value for you as the end consumer. And then I think the second thing is having been in the space for a while and built a bunch of stuff, just depth of the tech stack when you're dealing with a self-directed real-time brokerage, especially across multiple asset classes, is also orders of magnitude different than building, call it your average robo-advisor. And not to throw shade on anybody, but I think the reality is that allowed a lot of the incumbents to catch up faster and build that a lot faster. And I think building a mobile self-directed brokerage with fractional execution capabilities across multiple asset classes is just a different beast. You have much more highest degree of concurrent usage with, anyone will tell you from a technology standpoint, is the hard thing to scale in our space is concurrent use. How many users are looking at the app at the same time, especially if you're looking at the same stock and all that stuff. So there's, even from a technology standpoint, a totally different set of problems that you have to solve for with a self-directed brokerage relative to something like a robo-advisor.
And when you were focusing on the UI, UX part of it, that's your background. And something we've talked about before we got on was a lot of these financial service startups came about, especially in the 2021 phase. There was this notion that people are going to disrupt financial services. They were young founders, and it was almost like a badge of honor that they had never been in finance. And now it feels like it swung the other way. Doing our research, you've been in this space for a long time. It's not just like you were, I'm going to flip over the brokerage industry with my UX design. So maybe go into a little bit of how along your career you ended up at this point today.
And it's funny, before I go into that, we talk often in our hiring, corporate America really likes their badges. Where did you work? Which school you went to? And then there was a point in time where suddenly they like, if you didn't have a badge, because then you're new and innovative or whatnot, but even not having a badge became a badge. So it's always a thing. And I think what you're seeing happening, hopefully right now, is everybody's going back to first principles. The Palantir CEO was talking a little bit about this at Davos, Alex Karpov. I just do my own testing of every single thing that comes through the door. I don't care where you went to school. I don't care where you worked before. I take a first principle approach to everyone that I hire. I think that's an incredibly healthy way to approach things. For myself, I started actually, to your point, in design back when Adobe Flash was still cool, if anyone remembers. That was the only way to make really fancy websites. I was 13 years old or something, so super early. It also allowed me to charge a lot of money for it because it's way before the existence of Squarespace and Wix. So that was my paper route. When I was 17 years old, I joined Saxo Bank, which was an online broker in Europe. They're an EU-regulated bank, but it's really an investing platform for the most part. And that was such a hyper-growth company and one of the fastest-growth companies in Europe. You can think about it for the American listeners, the European version of E-Trade. And I think I was employee two, maybe 300 around there. 12 months in, we had 1,000 employees. So it was surreal to be 18 years old working at this company, being part of the 20-30% that had been there the longest. And still actually having near zero experience. It was super fun. After that, a bunch of us left to start another company across London and Europe. And we actually left in 08. So it was one of these things where we had this whole idea that we were going to roll up a bunch of brokerages in emerging markets.
I'm assuming it was early 08 and not late 08.
Exactly. It was early enough that our first LP was Lehman Brothers. Well, really our only LP, because they obviously didn't end up ever writing a check. So we ended up being, for a quick minute, I guess you could see the idiots that had left the rocket ship that was Saxo Bank. And then on the back of that, we pivoted to some different models and managed to build a business out of that. So that was more you're forced to come up with something. What we ended up building was API trading and credit facilitation, which obviously credit was a huge issue at the time, especially for a lot of SME money managers and funds and regional brokerages that had to clear with the big banks in London. Suddenly they had to put up 20, 30, 40 million euros or dollars overnight to keep their credits with the banks, and they couldn't do that. And so we were in a situation where we'd been looking at rolling a bunch of them up. And then instead we pivoted to a model where, okay, if you put a tenth of that collateral with us, we can net out the flow. And by doing so, we can then extend some credit back into the space. And that obviously, if you're ahead of risk at any of these things, you would take that all day long at that moment. So it was like trying to make the timing actually work to our advantage, because initially it was not great to try to be a financial entrepreneur in 08, but I think we made it to our advantage and spent 8 years with that company building out a bunch of different things. We built out risk management software. We ended up with a clientele of, I want to say four, maybe 500 B2B clients around the world, including in Asia. We built an API platform for third-party developers to start building software for them. So think more things like algorithmic trading and the like, which was called Tradable, which I ran, and that was incubated, if you will, within the group. And then in 2016, the business was acquired by a company in the UK. And at the time, I had been in the space for about 10 years. And I was looking around, and I was living in London at the time, actually. And then at the same time as that acquisition happened, Brexit happened. And yeah, I would say that at that time, London was the fintech of the world, because I think due to 08, New York never really got there until then after Brexit, where it very quickly then flipped over because everybody just wanted to escape then London at that time. And I was one of those guys. So I moved to New York at that time and took a year where I got back to my design roots, actually, because I just realized I'd been doing so much selling that I hadn't been fine tuning my design skill set. I could sort of direct design, but as far as I actually like drawing the pixels with my own two hands, I've always enjoyed it a lot. So I took a year where I really went back to basics and worked with a ton of different startups, just really to expose myself to a bunch of problems that I could solve by way of design. And then soon enough, one of those problems was back in the investing realm. And that's what we call public today, I suppose.
So if I look at the self-directed brokerage business model, this might be an oversimplification, but I can think of three ways that these things make money. I guess four. One would be they used to charge commissions for trading, but that seems like it's all but gone away. They could earn interest on cash balances. So money that's left there, they could potentially use that money to generate money for themselves. They could lend through margin lending, and they can sell order flow. I don't know if that's exactly the way, but that's how I think about the revenue. Is there a revenue I'm missing? And is that how public makes money?
I think for the incumbents, you're right, obviously. I do think that there are a few new revenue streams that have unveiled themselves. So let's take them one by one. Zero commission is only really true for equities. We all charge for crypto trading. We have alternatives on the platform. We have bonds. So equities is just the one thing that has zero commission. And I think in our case, we have this public premium, which is our $10 a month membership where we waive all this stuff. But if you don't have that, we might also charge you for an extended hours trade, for instance, et cetera. So I think zero commission, generally speaking, is true for equities, but it's an asset class specific thing so far, I would say. Generally, the way we look at it, we bucket it actually a little different. We bucket it as asset-based revenue. So that's basically where the function is, a function of AUM. Interest falls into that, but also products you have management fees on fall into that. And then securities lending largely falls into that as well. Then I think there's a transactional bucket where it's exactly your commission or spread on crypto, real-time money movement. We have some free tiers. And then if you want to move in a lot of money and you want to have that show up in your buying power immediately, we charge for that as well. And then the third bucket is just software, essentially. So that's our premium subscriptions and things like Alpha AI, which we can talk about a little bit later too. But that's a little bit how we think about it. So I would say it's maybe like 50, 60% the same, but then there's these new revenue streams that also have become unlocked. Also in large part through the engagement curve that you have in this product is just on mobile. It's very different because an active trader used to be somebody who sits there with their web app or downloadable EXE Windows thing where there are seven screens and they're sitting there. And those folks still exist, but now you have this whole new segment in the market which just open their phone 10, 15 times a day. And they don't need the seven screens to be actively tracking the market. And like I said, whenever you have a change in engagement curve, you just have a dramatic shift in your opportunity to build UX and to monetize as well. And I think that's where ultimately a lot of those things stem from.
So one of the things you didn't mention, and this was a big deal in the brokers, and I don't know if it was the meme stocks that really made it a public issue, but there's always been this discussion of payment for order flow. And I think one of the reasons why it didn't make headlines were when commissions went to zero, if you're not charging, usually that means you're making money somewhere else. And the idea was that all these retail traders, their flow could be sold to someone who could buy first refusal or see that order flow earlier. Did you guys participate in that? Maybe give an overview of payment for order flow and then your view on it as a company.
Yeah, I think you described payment for order flow pretty well. And for accuracy, we should also say there's payment for order flow in the equities world, or like call it the single stock trading world. And then there's payment flow in the options trading world. And those two actually have some different mechanics that we can get into. So I would say you're right. In January 2021, after GameStop, especially, the whole thing became an issue because that was the first time that you really had a breach of trust that led to a questioning of brokerages' incentives. And by the way, Public was participating in payment for order flow before that, actually. It's just something that comes out of the box when you set up a brokerage. You go through all the trouble of getting regulated, strike an agreement with a clearing firm, and it's just there. And we've always looked at that. And I think in our Series A pitch deck, Graycroft and some of the other companies that backed us back then will attest to this. We never really loved that model. We always like long-term projections, wrote that off. We were always like, it's legal in the UK, it's illegal in Australia. Europe now has a ban on the table, but there was talks about that already then. So it almost felt for us, okay, long-term, is this a solid thing to bet the entire business on? Maybe not. But at the time, we didn't have anything better. So it was like, okay, we'll have it for now. After the events at GameStop, I think two things became clear. Number one, retail investors historically have always had this brand image of like being the dumb money. And I think it was shocker for many, especially the folks that hadn't been hanging out on Wall Street best as much, that these were really literate people. These were people that understood very sophisticated trade setups, including short squeezes and the like. And so suddenly we were like, okay, if people understand those things, they also understand payment for order flow. But it seemed like prior to that, it just been too difficult to talk about. It's too complicated to explain. All that shone a lot of spotlight on that. And there was a lot of skepticism, we think for the right reasons, around what brokerages' incentives are. So we stepped away from that.
When you did that, was it painful? You don't have to share numbers, but was it a large percentage or is this a small amount of money?
Actually, no. So I think we were early enough that we didn't have a material innovator's dilemma there. And that's essentially, that was our arbitrage at the time. If you look at a bunch of other people in the space, some were a year away from IPOing and making $1 billion already. So obviously that was a real innovator's dilemma thing for them. And honestly, if I'd been in competitor's shoes, I obviously wouldn't have done it. We were just the youngest, I think, of those companies. We launched in September of 2019. So we were still an 18-month-old company at the time. So we were early enough that we could still remodel and re-underwrite how we wanted to build the business model. This company would be very hard to do if we had been later stage. I'll be honest, would have been very hard to do. And at the time, there was a little bit of, oh, this is nice, guys, but is it actually smart? And we were totally convinced that it was the right thing to do, but it was also the smart thing to do, especially considering how much scrutiny there ended up being about payment for order flow, both in terms of brand and customers and on the Hill, regulatorily, everything else. Now, when people started to dive into this, they also started to understand that, okay, the execution that you get if you trade with a brokerage that is payment for order flow might actually be worse than if you don't, because you can think about it like this. By the way, you stop any person on the street and you say, hey, when you buy a stock, what do you think happens? Especially in New York, they'd be like, oh, it goes down to the stock exchange. That's actually not what happens in most cases. So it goes to a market maker, it goes to these pools. And in the single stock equities world, payment for order flow is a little bit like having exclusivity on that order flow. So that means if I'm a market maker and I receive an order, I just have to execute it within the NBBO, the national best bid and offer. But I can actually give the worst price within the NBBO. And because I see all that order flow, I could have potentially filled it at a better price, but because nobody else is competing to execute that order, I can just execute at whatever price I want within the NBBO. That's conceptually how you can think about it. And I think back during the days where retail volume was 6-7% of the market, that was not a big deal because it turns out the way the NBBO is calculated, it doesn't include what they call odd lots. So basically anything less than 100 shares, definitely doesn't include fractional shares. These were all innovations that had come within the last couple of years. So fast forward to today, where retail is 25-30% of the volume, you now have an NBBO that's potentially 25-30% skewed off where the actual market could be. But nobody then sees that price because it's not actually on exchange. That's what's so crazy, because you all think about, you say stock, I say exchange. It's the first thing that would pop into people's minds. That's where the model became very questionable. We then said, hey, we're going to go directly to lit exchanges, as they're called. And we were able to prove that more often than not, that resulted in actually better execution for our clients. And there are multiple ways to measure execution quality. And we published a lot of the stuff that people can look up if they want to go deeper on that. But we looked at it from a number of different aspects, intellectually, honestly, and found that we were able to do that. And it roughly netted out that the difference was that it was okay, maybe the market maker and the broker dealer would have otherwise made, now back in your pocket. More often than not, that was the rough math that we ended up with.
So you mentioned that's how it works on the equity side. Can you explain how the options payment for order flow is different?
So in the options market, a market maker will still receive the flow, but instead of just internalizing that flow, which means they just execute it and provide a fill themselves, as long as that within the national best bid and offer, they have to go and exchange and execute it. So all the options has almost like a two-leg thing, whereas the market maker gets it first, but then it goes on exchange. Now the market maker has a right of first refusal to fill that order. Effectively, they get first pass at it. And so they might be at a slight advantage, but it still goes on exchange where there is open competition amongst a bunch of other market makers. So said in another way, if you're a market maker, you're paying to get an order in, you go to the exchange. If somebody has a better fill, even though you paid for it, that market maker will fill that order and the customer will see the benefit of that. So that's a pretty distinct difference because it creates what the SEC also calls an open competition model, an open auction model, relative to these restricted competition trading centers, as the SEC calls them in their proposal. So by the way, they've largely proposed changes to the equities payment for order flow model now, which I would say is loosely modeled on how it works in the option space, where it is more transparent and there is more competition. And I think that's what anybody really wants at the end of the day. You just want there to be competition to fill orders because we just know competition leads to better outcome for consumers. And largely speaking, monopolies lead to the opposite of whenever somebody has exclusive rights on something. And I would say that's probably the highest level abstracted way of thinking about it.
In the options market, do the other market makers know who has the right of first refusal or if there is a first right of refusal?
No, I mean, they might chat with each other and stuff on the Bloomberg terminal, but there's no like structured way for them to really understand that, I think. So with that, I would say the question is, I don't actually really know. And that's the most interesting answer. I don't know. It's obscure.
No, well, because I know we're getting deep in the weeds, but the interesting thing is when I go from equity to bond market with options in the middle, the bond market where I trade it and study, you have auctions and there's always this big fear that if someone's ever let a last look, that they would cheat. So in bonds, it's just straight up auction. Whoever has the highest price wins. There's no order flow. There's no access in that same way that these other markets have it. But it's interesting because it does seem like the options way is a lot more fair or better for the end consumer than the equities.
It totally is, without a doubt. And then you could ask the question, hey, is that still fair enough, so to say? And that's where I think the SEC is more about that right of first refusal aspect of things. Essentially doing a paired trade where you're basically like the market maker is bringing the order to the exchange. If they bring the order, they pay a little bit less fees for that. So in the full holistic economics, they are still at an advantage, but it's not 100% advantage, as is the case with a equities dark pool where nobody else sees that.
So now if I trade options on public.com and that order flow gets paid, where's that money going?
So we decided as the first brokerage ever, I think, to send back half of our revenue on payment for order flow directly to the end user. And we did that because payment for order flow in the options trading world, it's not as bad as it is. In the equities, it doesn't come with the same trade-offs and consequences, I think, that you see on the equity side. And then secondly, we're not regulated as a market maker, by the way. So even if we wanted to bring the trade directly to the exchanges ourselves, we would have to sign up for, I think, 17 different exchanges or something. And that would be a lot of work. So we decided to work with market makers on this, but then pass back half of that revenue directly into the pocket of the retail investor, which means that now payment for order flow can be something that doesn't just benefit market makers and broker dealers as it has done for decades, but now it can be directly beneficial to the end customer as well.
You earlier had mentioned fractionalization, which was one of the first ways I found out about you, because fractionalization in equities, the idea that even though stock could have a price of $1,000, you could just buy 20, which I think for a lot of younger investors makes a lot more sense. Walk me through the history of fractionalization, and then I'm excited to get into the bond space because that's a space that it seems even harder to do.
Absolutely. So I think what was curious is we did a lot of research up front, obviously, and quite honestly, even when I came to this country and I opened a brokerage account with one of the incumbents and I emailed the broker like, hey, I want to buy, I don't know, I think it was like $5,000 at Netflix and $10,000 at Disney and this and that. He'd call me back up and he'd be like, yeah, I executed you for 478 shares of this. And I ended up with all these weird odd amounts. And I was like, okay, sure, but this is not actually precisely what I wanted. Maybe I'm too OCD, but that suddenly looked super strange in my portfolio. And I would, my cost basis have to be some arbitrary numbers. And I think that's what initially got us onto that. Okay, at the same time, by the way, you had Bitcoin, which was born on the internet. So therefore, it didn't come with this baggage of having to buy one full coin to participate in that market. And then we just put the two and two together and be like, we should really try to retrofit the stock market to have this. It's actually worked the same way for the 200 years that it's existed, which is you buy full shares of companies. And then I think going back to UI, UX, in a world where it's mobile, in a world where everybody's used to Venmoing each other by just punching in a number, that's the interface that you want. And then I started thinking about the UX already of just being able to have one big screen, you punch in a dollar amount, you hit done, and you're done, versus having to do all the math. I met one of the early Apple guys. The one thing I learned from Steve Jobs is a lot of people, they don't want to do all that weird math on their screen. There was some anecdotes from the iTunes and how they're messing around all that stuff, et cetera. So I think we often look back at this and being like, hey, Circ was important. I think it existed in large part for, I would say, the wealthier clientele before 2013, because it's a very easy thing to change in any CRM system in a back office of being like, this client pays no commission, that's it. Fractional, I think, was in many ways probably a greater innovation. And then it obviously happened before COVID, where a lot of people came into the market. But I would argue that had that not been around as we had gotten into COVID in March 2020, you wouldn't necessarily have seen the same uptake because it just made the markets so much more comprehensible for a lot of people. And fractional before that, you could, in theory, ETFs have a degree of fractional ownership. You can buy funds that have that too. But being able to, in real time, look at a stock, hit the buy button, punch in 50, 100 bucks, totally irrespective of where it's trading. That, I think, was the big innovation, doing that on your phone. And I think that's a big part, at least, of why you saw the tens of millions of people joining the markets that did in 2020 and 2021, in addition to, obviously, all the macroeconomic factors and everything else.
Did it change how most people on your platform buy and sell positions? Or was this more focused towards someone who only had $500, but trying to get them diversified exposure? Like if a client has $500,000, are they still using round numbers because they have the Jonic OCD that I want to have $10,000 positions because I'm used to that in crypto? Or is this really a smaller account phenomenon that brought more people to the investing markets?
So it's actually not the OCD thing. It's if you dollar cost average, which a lot of people like to do. If you direct index, if you build a portfolio of 50 or 100 names, you want to control that yourself, and you want to buy up in those companies, like you want to rebalance that on an ongoing basis, even with $100,000 of your account, that becomes annoying to do in full shares. And that's not even an OCD thing. It's just Warren Buffett's been telling people for decades, diversify and optimize your taxes. Take your tax loss hours. And it's for the longest of time been easier said than done because it's diversifying and rebalancing. That's hard to do if you have to do it in full increments all the time, especially if you want a diversified portfolio. And I think that's why also before the invention of fractional, you saw a lot more, I would argue, of this penny stock action, a lot more accounts that owned fewer assets, a lot more accounts that just had, if I'm a self-directed investor or trader, that meant that I had two or three companies that I was buying, but that was it. Now, if you're a self-directed investor, you can have hundreds of companies in your portfolio and you can manage them all down to a dollar. And that's a big innovation, not just for the folks that couldn't afford to buy one full share of Amazon when it was trading at $3,000, but honestly, for most of the country and all the way up to the more affluent segment who just wants to manage their accounts a little bit better.
You made a great point that zero balance versus fractional. Zero balance was a big deal, but really it's just a click of a button. Giving people stuff for free isn't that hard.
Zero commission. Yeah. Or zero balance too.
But as someone who loves the inner workings of systems and how the markets work, when I learned about fractional, I was like, wow, that was a very clever but hard to orchestrate problem because what you're doing is essentially at the end of every night, if there's less than one share, somebody has to warehouse that risk. So for a simple example, there's 500 stocks. If someone buys a dollar, each of them was $100 price, there's $99 you have to own. And I was like, oh, that was so clever how they figured that out. But now if we go to the bond market, we've got a much bigger problem. And even if you just start with the corporates, A corporate bond, typically by definition, can't be broken up into anything less than $2,000, and their prices can range all over the place. So how do you take the innovation from equity to fixed income?
So I think the first thing to be mindful of, because you're exactly right, it's certainly a taller order to do, I would say. And for the readers, Public has announced that we're getting into corporate bonds. We launched treasuries last year. As I think the six-month T-bill was the most invested in asset in 2023. So that's been very successful. And now we're getting into corporate bonds. I think the first thing to be mindful of is, what does fractional mean in the context of fixed income versus equities? Because it might not mean a dollar. It might mean $100, $500. And the way that the bond space works and the fixed income space works, obviously, being, let's say, 8% yield on $10 is also not that interesting. So it's a little bit like, does that even make sense? And obviously, fixed income, generally speaking, is much less volatile than equities. And so it doesn't necessarily mean that we have to take it all the way down there. And I think that's the first and most important thing to realize. And that's, I think, also been our learning since we announced it, that, okay, we need to now re-educate a little bit. Because it's interesting, with equities, we need to educate people what fractional was, we thought, but actually people just picked up the phone and be like, this makes a ton of sense, done. The education barrier was very low. Now they've come to understand it, and now you got to re-educate. The fractional fixed income space might mean something slightly different than it ever did in the equity space. And that's a little bit of a larger challenge that we're dealing with almost like in real time right now, as corporate bonds is literally rolling out as we speak.
So fractionalization, no payment for order flow. I'm curious, when I think about brokerages, they obviously are great businesses. You look at their fundamentals, it's something I'd want to own personally. However, on the other side, I think the bear case or the skeptic is, look, this is a commodity. They're all just fighting with each other. Prices go to zero. Or the opposite is, these are great self-directed, but as soon as those accounts generate wealth, they're going to move on to a more full service. When you think about differentiation amongst brokers, both incumbents and the new players, how do you view the landscape?
I totally agree with you. It's such a paradox. At the same time, you would make the statement that brokerages are commoditized. And at the same time, you look at all the brokerages and they're trading at 80, 90, 95% gross margins. How are those two statements true at the same time? And I think the truth is they might not be also. But if you really look at the evolution of the space, I would say generally, I'll go all the way back to Charles Schwab, which I would credit with being the original inventor of the discount brokerage, as it's known. And by the way, that was $75 a trade, I think, was his first idea for the discount brokerage. Just to put that in perspective, in, I guess, 70s or 60s dollars, what would that even be today with inflation? I don't know, but a lot of money, commission. But it always competed on price. And then over time, price went down, but technology accelerated and went up. So over time, you're starting to compete more and more on technology, on how your product works, on UX, UI, on whether people can do what they want to do. And by the way, investors and traders come in all forms and sizes. They go from folks that are making what they would themselves describe as degenerate bets on some call options that are way out of the money, all the way down to just putting money in a 5.10% yield account like we have in Public, or buying treasuries, which is probably one of the least risky things that you can do. So there's just a huge spectrum there. And depending on who you are, you want a different set of features and technologies and products that are available to you. So I think that's generally the trend that you've seen. And again, it takes me back to what I said in the beginning with, then it went on web, then you had all these tools on web, then it's like, okay, then it went mobile. And now super, super early days, but there's a lot of stuff happening around AI where if you go to Public now and you swipe down on any stock, Alpha will come up, which is our research assistant chatbot, and you can ask any questions about the stock, which is just a totally different user interface and a user experience as a researcher. Whereas before, you'd scroll down to filings, you'd sit there, listen to the earnings call. We have all the financials, the balance sheet statements, the cash flow, the earnings reports. You have all that stuff, the analyst ratings, but you have to consume all that in a still time-consuming way, but it's much easier from back when you have to print it out. So it's, again, you're just seeing these 100x improvements in, I guess you could call it productivity as an equity researcher, or any asset researcher, frankly. And I would say AI is now what's pushing the frontier of that. And I think we're now playing with Alpha being not just reactive, the best assistants in the world are proactive. So now it's something where Tesla, as we're taping this, had earnings last night, and Alpha comes up to me and literally before Elon hangs up the phone, this is exactly where they came out at. This is exactly what happened. This is the sentiment. This is how trading the after hours, et cetera, without me actively having to go and fish for that information. So it's happened because I own the stock, unfortunately, because it was down 13%, not financial advice. So I think technology is really the main thing that is a constant change. And you've seen people just move from competing on price to competing on technology. And then I would say the third thing is trust. And everyone will be like, duh, of course. But I think most people will sign off on the statement that while trust has always been important in financial services, today it is more important than ever. And especially if you think about the millennial generation, you have 08, obviously financial services trust took a huge hit. That same year, Satoshi writes the white paper for Bitcoin. That becomes, over the next 10 years, increasingly like, oh, trust in Bitcoin instead of the government and instead of regulators, all the way up to Terra Luna, eventually FTX, and suddenly all trust is eroded in the crypto space as well. And then, by the way, shortly after that, you had Silicon Valley Bank. Trust just is this thing where it continues to be just, in my optic, the scarcest thing that you can have as a financial services provider. It's something that we take extremely seriously. And I don't necessarily always talk to the team here about building the fanciest UI or whatever. I talk about how can we build the most trusted investing app for the next generation, period, full stop. If you're asking me what's eventually the North Star, that's that. Now, technology plays a part of that. But ultimately, getting to that North Star is just the thing that is the most important, I would say, to any financial service company.
The trust is an interesting lens because I agree that in financial services, tell people, when you think about what people care about, they usually care about their family, their health, their wealth, and then there's a bunch of other things. So you're not their doctor, but when someone entrusts you with a dollar, when you become a fiduciary, it's the greatest responsibility I've been ever given, and it's not to be taken lightly. That juxtaposition against risk-taking in the markets versus innovation in tech, there's obviously trade-offs there of the tech Silicon Valley move fast and break things doesn't always align with the 100-year-old financial services. So when we think about something like artificial intelligence, as someone who's a techno-optimist, loves everything, I also remain skeptical over how this might work. So we've seen computers do really well in very fast math calculations for momentum, for speed, for high-frequency trading. Just the notion that if you actually were buying payment for order flow, if I could see all the orders, throw that into a computer, I could probably guess what's going to happen within the next 300 milliseconds. Fundamental research, where I started, the idea was, yeah, we use quant, but it was really on the ground, talking to analysts, talking to management. So Alpha, which is the name of your AI model, how have you gotten to that level of belief that this is a good idea, given that we have hallucinations, we have imperfect technology, that it's still a growing and naive thing, and it's that ready to be released, and the risk that what would happen if you lost any trust with something like that?
So by the way, the number one KPI for the team that's working on Alpha since day one, where we saw that, okay, this feels magical, actually, that I could just ask you this and here we go, is to get the error rate down, basically hallucinations, as you call it. Get that as far down as you humanly can. And so that's the one chart that just every week is going down and to the right. Most charts you want going up and to the right, this is reverse. And I think, obviously, we have a lot of disclaimers in place and we make sure also for the UX for people to understand that alpha obviously means it's a little bit of a double play, but it also what comes before beta, and a beta is the first thing that you release to your customer base if you're a technology company. So I think we're not 100% there yet and there will always be things, but I think it's also, we haven't even worked on this for, I don't know, maybe half a year, maybe 7 months, something like that. So to see that chart and how far it's trending down is quite incredible as well, I would say. I think generally the issue you have today is very different than the issue you had 10 years ago. 10 years ago, the issue was, how do I get the information? How do I get the right information to make the right decision? Today, the issue is information overload. There is too much information. There are a million news articles on any particular topic. There are so many analyst ratings. By the way, there's not just stock analysts now. There are YouTubers, there are Discord people. There are a whole new breed, if you will, of analysts out there whose opinions you might also want to take a look at. And then there's also just, how should I listen to an earnings call? How do I read an earnings report? How do I read an annual report? How does all this stuff actually fit together? And so I think the problem that Alpha solves first and foremost is increasing the amount of people that make a high degree of research before they buy a stock. And so on a net basis, even if you had an error rate of your 1%, 2%, which would be quite high in my view, on a net basis, it's still such a net positive because of how easy you're making it, not just to do the research, but to actually comprehend everything that's going on. And that's why I'm so bullish on it. I think it's a huge net positive, a huge force for good, a huge potential game changer. And in many ways, it's interesting. One of the things that the whole neo broker, as we call it, industry, has come under fire of is like, hey, has it become too easy to buy a stock? I'm sure you've heard that whole rhetoric coming out from the Hill and from certain politicians, et cetera. This is the antidote, in my opinion, a little bit. Okay, so if it has, well, then it's really helpful to have this research assistant in your pocket that can actually give you that context, even if you're not asking the question. It can tell you. So if you look at ratio of like how many people are well-informed before they make a purchase, it's going to bring that number way up.
I'm much more on the other side of that, where people playing with crypto, buying stocks, even meme stocks, anything that gets a younger population more financially literate, more into saving, more into understanding compounding, I'm for it. Even if I think that...
But of course I am too. I'm not saying that was my position. I'm saying that's an argument that exists. And so I think it's just such an antidote to that argument.
I'm at the Hill. I know what side you're on. It was more Congress's view of this, because I do think that, I'll be honest, when I first saw some of this stuff, it made me feel old real quick, because I'm like, oh my God, they're gamifying this. The brokerage companies that I use, when you want to trade options, you had to fill out 12 levels of forms and ask you all these questions. I went on an app, I won't say which one, but stars are flashing and confetti's blowing off of it. And I was like, this is a game where I want to push younger people into investing, because I do think it's a good, important thing for society. But I do worry sometimes about knowing that tech mobile gaming is the best way to capture that. There's a fine line.
Totally. And by the way, I'm a designer, so I love confetti on an app as much as the next guy. But I've always said that the stock market is gamified enough as it is. We don't need to overly gamify it. So we've never done those things. Our onboarding is actually much more just minimalist and slick, and it's not a million colors, and it's just straightforward. I also think a lot of the folks who did that stuff, they've since rolled it back, obviously, because maybe there was the realization that it was a step too far. And one of the definitions of gamifying, by the way, there are a few out there, is invoking an emotional response from a user. The stock market does that on its own. We don't need to help. That just happens. People are, by the way, very passionate about the companies they're investing in. So even especially retail that buy a lot of consumer brands, there's already a big emotional connection to what people are buying in many cases. Then there's an emotional connection to the position once they own something, because it goes up, it goes down, it's red, it's green. So there's enough of that already, and you don't actually need to do a lot. So I think design philosophically, we've always thought about it more like, let's get out the way and just make the product as easy as possible without trading it off from being powerful and sophisticated. And that ultimately is probably the hardest balance of my day job, is to navigate that balance of simplicity and sophistication. But that's also the fun part, if I'm being totally honest.
It's funny you said that. I was thinking of a trader who had turned his screen black and white. He traded for a long time, and the red and green evoke emotion, and just always wanted black and white lines. Or one guy did everything in inverse. So ups were downs and downs were ups, because his brain couldn't see it fast enough. And it was meant as like this play.
That's a cool feature, the black and white thing. I might steal that. That's fun.
You're welcome.
That'd be like a fun setting to have in the app.
I do think turning greens and reds off, I don't use it, helps. I think that red, we don't even have red pens on trading desks because of what it symbolizes. So if you ever saw like a red anywhere, you just get rid of it because of what it evokes. So going black and white is what I use.
We actually on public now, when you just look at your account, not when you look at a stock, when you look at account, you can see just the equity holding over time. That chart is actually now blue. And then you can flip over to see performance, weighted return, et cetera. And those are obviously green or red, but we're defaulting to the blue one now as well. It's kind of funny. I like that idea.
So the biggest rage, it feels like almost to a fever pitch at times, is alts. Everyone wants to get into alts, alts, alts. So I think when people hear alts, I think of private credit and venture capital and real estate. But you guys on the website had music royalties, which I just thought was super cool, because I think that there's something more social and fun and almost Web3 crypto about music royalties than buying Dunkin' Donuts and strip malls, which I'm sure is a great investment. And I want to cover that. But today we're going to cover music royalties.
I was about to say, you'd be surprised. By the way, I totally agree with you. The term alts have also been one of these terms that have been redefined in real time over the last couple of years, especially from a generational perspective. So for you, it means PEVC. For 20-year-old, it means Nike sneakers or Yeezys or baseball cards or whatever. So that's one of the interesting things. So we added also the platform because we also started to recognize, back to what you said before about, hey, the earlier we can get people to put money to work in the markets and build their financial literacy, the better. We just believe that hands down. I think if you look at a generation that started investing when they were 35, 38 years of age, which I think roughly is the case for the boomer generation, they could have started 20 years earlier. If you look at what the compounded returns of that could have been, it's economy changing if you could have had that be the case. So we've always been very keen on just making sure that's the case. We obviously can only onboard brokerage customers when they're 18, but I even think if you sign up and you're 17, that we can't onboard you, but we're going to send you a free stock on your birthday or something. So we've always been huge believers in that. We've done a lot of work around that. Now, here's the thing. How do you define the markets in that context? Historically, we used to say just equities. Today, I think you'd say crypto as well. And the reality is there are a lot of people that today own stock in Amazon, Apple, Tesla, and the Magnificent Seven ETFs even, whose first trade was Bitcoin. So with every generation, every segment of customers, you have the enter into the markets through a different door. So the beginning of the journey basically matters less than the end or the journey itself. And I think we started to see that was starting to happen in the alt space too, that there are actually folks out there who their first experience investing was collectibles, sneaker hats, et cetera. So that's why we initially got into that business. And we got into that business by way of an acquisition, by the way. So we acquired a company that used the Reg A Plus framework. So this is not like a Web3 thing. This is fully SEC registered securities. Effectively, we have a Delaware company that buys an asset, and then we do a mini IPO of that company is how you can think about it, so that you can buy shares in that company that then owns that asset. And then we started getting really creative because also with yield coming back and the stock market dropping back at the end of 2022, a lot of people were getting more hungry for cash flowing assets. And through various connections, we were fortunate enough to have a bunch of celebrities that have invested, and some of them are in music. Chainsmokers are investors. They're great guys, and they've been dabbling in and around this space too. So we're like, yeah, there are actually some music royalties that are really interesting investments. And one we did, the one you referenced a couple of months ago, was the music rights for Shrek, the movie, the franchise, as you say. And it's just so interesting. We looked at the historical turns and they were between 8 to 10%, I think. We publish all this in the app, so you can go and check it out. Don't take my word for it. But with very little decay, almost no decay, because it's a franchise that keeps putting out movies, there are spinoffs. And I think what's interesting about royalties as a category is in the era of streaming, they've had a big comeback. And I'm not just talking streaming as Spotify. I'm talking the music you put on your Instagram story or your TikTok. There's a little cut happening there all the time. And this had historically sat with just one owner. And now it can be tens of thousands of owners who all can actually listen to that song, come online on the radio or on an Instagram story and be like, hey, I made a little piece of that. That's awesome. So I think that's a super interesting category. I think that IPO got oversubscribed pretty quickly within a matter of a couple of weeks. So something that we think is also just at these times, a great diversifier of your portfolio. It's highly uncorrelated. There's been this whole debate for ages. Is crypto and equities market correlated? Is it not? When is it correlated? Sometimes it seems to be, sometimes it isn't. The bond market, the equity market is correlated. And therefore, also you could argue there's a correlation, maybe more of an inverse between the bond market and the crypto market. Also just completely outside of all of that. Also trading on totally different fundamental input drivers in the valuation that makes up that asset. It has to do with, in this case, how many folks are putting Shrek music on their Instagram stories and on their YouTubes and stuff like that.
When you say it went public, did they really IPO as a publicly traded security, or is this a private asset only available?
We actually IPO'd it. So it was a private asset. We bought a part of it. We took that ownership part, put it in a company that we then did a small IPO of. So now that's a publicly traded security on the public app, but only on the public app.
That's what I meant. So like, does that ticker trade in the New York Stock Exchange or only trades on public?
It's over the counter, right? So there's an ATS, an alternative exchange that it runs through that we do. And so we're only doing it currently with our own user base, if you will, because we are the only BD on that exchange. But in theory, that is an exchange that could have other BDs. And not sure if we talked about it publicly, but now I'll tell about it. We have had thinking about, okay, there is maybe a world where the real play here might be the exchange versus actually just being the BD, because obviously most markets, including this one, fundamentally benefits from more liquidity.
And if I buy that, do I get a dividend just like a stock would pay me out?
It pays us a dividend. Exactly. The royalty.
That's really cool. Fun alternative. Are there other alternatives that you think make sense, or was this just a very strategic because of the acquisition and the type of market it fit?
I think there's a ton that makes sense. I'm a watch guy. I like watches. I'd love to add some. Those returns might be more correlated, by the way, with the S&P 500 as, but nevertheless, watches are interesting. Art's an interesting category. There's a lot about vintage cars, wine. There's all these different asset classes where, again, the fractional component is very important for your ability to even add that kind of exposure to your portfolio, because I'm not going to start buying vintage cars, but I might like it as an investment profile and as a diversifier in my portfolio. And a lot of these spaces saw a lot of volume in 2021. It's tapered off a little bit because it is higher out of the risk curve. Absolutely, it's one of the most speculative things you can do. In the case of royalties, there's actually some royalties. It's a cash flow producing asset, so that I consider to be a little bit different. But things like art obviously doesn't generate any, there's no fundamental valuation of it. You could say it's purely speculative. So some of those assets did a little bit better in 2021 at the peak of the market. But we take a long-term view on this business, and I think it's a super interesting business. Generally, the whole theme of the securitization of everything, we still long-term believe can be super interesting. And I think a couple of years ago, everybody believed in it, but the question is it going to happen on-chain Web3, or is it going to be in a traditional setting? And then now, given what happened with the Web3 space and where that sits, I think most people believe how the regulators are approaching it, maybe that, okay, the SEC regulated approach to this seems like the right way forward right now.
That was going to be my follow-up question. If you thought we'd ever get back to real-world assets on-chain.
It'll probably exist. This framework works pretty well for us, at least. So I would question, what problem does it solve? And is it solving anything 10 times better than the Reg A Plus framework does? Because that's roughly the test that I think you need to run yourself through if you're founding a company. And I don't know that that's the case yet for a lot of this on-chain Web3 stuff. It might get there. But right now, I wouldn't say that it really does. What do you think?
Well, for watches, royalties, wine, art, I totally agree with you. I think the model you've done, Rally Road, Otis, I think the people that went down that, it made sense to me.
It was Otis we bought, by the way.
Oh, it was Otis. Okay, so I liked the concept, but now I love the fact that you made it a tradable ticker with a dividend. That just cleans it up. I didn't like the logon. I didn't need a special portfolio. So tightening that up, I think getting back to your early point and how you know about the piping of the markets, the thing that geeks me out the most on the settlement layer is for fixed income, you have over 2 million individual CUSIPs with a million being created every year. So you're just constantly pumping out instruments, and settlement and clearing is such a pain in the ass. So all the cool stuff that you built on the equity side, the fractionalization, the trading and stuff you're pushing on, that's like the thing you saw. When you saw the Bitcoin fractionalization idea, fixed income is just a mess to move around, to trade, to settle. And there's so much intermediaries. That's the one real world asset, debt in particular, that I think has the most promise. Whereas niche alternatives, specialty sneakers, shoes, watches, I don't think you need a new system for them. I can see why people would like a new system because of markets connection. So it's not the problem. It's more the distribution that young people have no problem buying a token. If that token was backed by a bunch of Jordans, they'd love it if you could avoid being a security.
I agree with that. And that's the thing. It came back to what I said in the beginning. Alts mean so many different things. You can be an 18-year-old buying Yeezys, or you can be a 70-year-old buying royalties. It also depends on what kind of customer you are and your demographic and so on.
Jack, this has been a lot of fun. You get to see the markets from the top down, people buying and selling everything. So I love talking to people like you or Pierce who get to like see the actual activity. We have the same closing question of where we are in the cycle. And so I'd be curious, where do you think we are today?
Probably in the middle between hope and depression in so many ways. Depression being in our very recent memories, but having now at least the, I'm not going to call it naivety, but at least allowing ourselves to be hopeful now, which I think is very different from a year ago. There was a while there where everybody said, oh, this is going to take a year. And then a year later, this is going to take a year. And then a year later, this is going to take a year. And now folks are not saying that anymore because Chairman Powell came out and said, I think 3 rate cuts in December. We'll see if he lives to regret that now with everything going on, inflation a little bit back up and GDP numbers and this, that, and the other. But at the end of the day, I think that represented the hope for folks of getting back to some normalized. And honestly, the last 15 years have just been so volatile. So again, when I think about our prime customer, that millennial customer, the mean regression that everybody talks to will be new for most folks. That's the interesting thing. And we just get back to 2.5% rates, 2.5% inflation, lock that in, and then not worry about it. And then letting other factors of the economy decide whether people are bearish or bullish. That used to be the case if you study economics, but in recent memory has not been the case. So I'm actually curious to see what that's going to do to the mindset of a lot of folks if we get there.
Well, Jack, thank you very much for joining us and sharing Public Story.
Yeah, thanks. I enjoyed this. It's fun.
If you enjoyed this episode, check out joincolossus.com. There you will find every episode of this podcast, along with transcripts, our weekly newsletter, and resources to continue your learning.